This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. Visit FUBARradio.com for more details.
Tom Latcham on FUBAR Radio.
Morning, freezing, isn't it? It's 10:03 here at FUBAR Radio. It's Tom Latcham, and welcome to the show. And it seems, if you read the papers, it's a day to have a go at left-wing pariahs. The right-wing press is having an absolute field day. Labour MP Tom Watson's under fire for wrongly accusing former Tory minister Leon Britton of rape, but he's refusing to apologise. This has understandably gone down like a fart in a spacesuit with the Conservatives, who shouted shame at him in the Commons, and the right-wing press, who've also gone for the jugular, partly because they hate how much he was anti-press when the whole Leveson inquiry was going on, I imagine. But it's a perfect target for them, and they're loving it. They're making hay while the sun shines against Mr. Tom Watson. Meanwhile, WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange is also in the news after the police scaled back its guard of the Ecuadorian embassy, where he's been staying since June 2012 while trying to avoid arrest over alleged sex crimes. This whole operation has cost £12 million, and the Met say they can no longer justify the cost of keeping an eye on him, but they will be covertly watching him, which they probably should have done a while ago. I think probably maybe stuck a van there with a camera on it. I hardly think you're going to get away. Mr. Assange is going to manage to get away in London, where there's more cameras than people. Naturally, this has also gone down pretty badly in the papers, and we'll be talking about the Julian Assange case, the Met Police's £12 million cost of watching him a little bit later in the show. And I welcome my co-presenter for the day, Mr. Dan Clark, who's a stand-up comedian and star of the BBC Three sitcom How Not to Live Your Life. He'll be staying with us for the full 2 hours, right and through until 12. And if you listened to my podcast, to my live Edinburgh show, he was a guest on that. So I thought he did so well in his audition that I thought I'd have him back. Hello, Dan. How are you, mate?
I thought it was quite presumptuous of you to say that I will be staying for the 2 hours.
we'll see how it goes, well, right?
You know, I might decide just to give up.
Or you might stay longer.
Yeah,
join one of the later shows later on in the day.
But still talking about these issues, yeah, even if it's got
really confusing them. I think the other shows, yeah, they do music and stuff.
Yeah,
like, so.
And I'll be going, but you know, I think he should have reported him to the authorities. Like, what?
Well, we'll be talking about that later. How are you anyway,
I'm
Mr.
good.
Clark?
Yeah, I'm very well. I'm still a little bit jet lagged. This sounds like I've deliberately brought this up.
Humble brag.
Yeah. But I have been. I'm not going to say where I've been, but I've been somewhere where you do get jet lag if you've been there for a while. All right, I've been
in LA.
Yeah. But the thing is, it's one of those places that you say and people go, ooh, LA. And you're like, well, it's...
Not if you were living in a bin like you were.
No, yeah. I was actually having to, you know, sell my
Nosh
body
people
for crack.
Up.
Yeah, and that's why people go, ooh.
But did you get a show out of it? Or were you selling your body didn't go down as well as you might have hoped?
No, it turns out that isn't the way to get a TV deal.
Well, that's how I got That's how I got on at FUBAR.
Is it?
What, you think I got on for my presenting skills?
This is amazing that your sort of barometer is that low that you're willing to do something that extreme for something that
you've got to use your strengths, play to your strengths, haven't you? I mean, that's how I rose up at the News of the World as well, you know.
I want to know how you knew this was a strength of yours.
Well, it works at the News of the World. Rebecca Butch couldn't get enough of this bod, put it that way. My old mate Rebecca. Listen, we'll stick with Dan, well, if he stays until 12 o'clock, and we'll do plenty of stuff coming up. But we've got a question of the day. After able-bodied Liverpool fan Jake Danner pretended to be in a wheelchair to get into the Merseyside derby recently, he was on the front page of The Sun yesterday getting all sorts of abuse. I want to know what tricks or blags you've pulled. I've got quite a few. I want to know what you've pulled. Tom at foodballradio.com, tweet us at foodballradio, or call us 0330 223 0200. That number again, 0330 223 0200. Dan, have a think. What blags have you pulled? What tricks have you pulled? You must have pulled a few, you know, being a sort of TV type. Yeah. If that's what you do, you pull tricks. You must have done in your time.
Yeah,
have a think. And also coming up, we'll be going through the papers in this, the News Hour, with Channel 4 journalist Paul McNamara. We'll be hopefully, he's here in the studio already, keen as mustard. We'll hopefully be getting maybe a blag from him too. I've certainly pulled a few blags in my time at work, which I'll be telling you a little bit about later. Not through our radio, when I work for the News of the World, the sort of tricks you'd have to pull on a regular basis, but aren't now allowed in newspapers. Don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but we'll talk more about that a little bit later.
Did you ever dress up as a sheikh?
No, that was someone else's job.
Oh, okay. The sheikh.
And that hasn't really played out that well for him either. He's now, I think he's been charged with something, so I don't think it's worked out that well for him either.
I have.
You've dressed up as a sheikh.
Yeah, but not to deceive anyone. It's just something I like to do at home on my own.
Sexual, is it?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, who doesn't find a shake sexy? And also,
sexy shake.
We'll be also talking to our author Matthew Small on the phone. He's written a book examining poverty in the UK, and we'll also be talking about the weekend's international football with world football expert James Montague. He's the man, if you remember the story about Serbia and Albania, when someone flew a drone into the stadium with a Kosovan Albanian flag on it, and it was ripped down by Serbia and it caused a riot, etc., etc. He recently interviewed the man who flew that drone, creating an international incident. So we'll be talking to him about that. I guess we should play a song, right, Dan?
Yeah, definitely. What have you got?
I've got all sorts, mate.
Sounds like someone who doesn't know what they're playing next.
Well, I mean, I've got all sorts. Let's just press a button and see how we go, yeah? It's FUBAR Radio, cool. It's 10:09. Hello, it's 10:13 here. It's Tom Latcham. I'm joined by my co-presenter, Dan Clark, comedian and star of TV shows and that. he's still here, and I can now introduce, he can finally talk, Mr. Paul McNamara from Channel 4 News.
Hello, Tom. How are you?
I'm all right. How are you, mate?
Yeah, I'm good. Although now I can hear my voice back, and I hate it. It's horrible.
But you do stuff on the telly for Channel 4 News.
I hate that as well. I watch it back. Do I really sound like that? It's awful.
Well, we used to work together once upon a time. In fact, we started in almost the first week. We both started in the same week, pretty much. And then we went on and worked at the News of the World, that was. And you've gone on to greatness while I work from home in my pants.
That is an utter lie, right? Because I was expecting to be.
You don't wear
your
pants.
I was expecting to be. You said, "Oh, come and do the radio show." I thought, yeah, it'd be great. And I was expecting to be in Tom's flat in his pants, but no. We're actually in like a la-di-da studio with actual computers, and there's a microphone here, and I'm listening to headphones. You've done well for yourself.
Yeah.
This is not what I expected or signed up for, Tom.
And how are you getting on Channel 4 News?
I'll say all right, and then my bosses will probably listen and go, "Him, he's terrible. He's awful. Let's get rid of him."
They'll be going, "Who is this guy? Do we employ him?
Is this one of ours?
Why isn't he at work?"
Be a lot of that.
But Paul, you're going to be helping us through the papers today. What are the? Let's have a look at some of the front pages. What are some of the front pages saying?
Oh, Tom, it's been so long since I've looked at a paper, now I'm TV and all. But okay, let's go through front pages.
I mean, that is just more like to do with Channel 4 News being completely unconnected to what's actually going on in the world.
Tom, I disagree.
Unless it's in Palestine, in which case it is. They are all over it.
We deal with issues. In fact, lots of these issues that we're going to go through here in the news were all on last night's show. So boom, back in your face, Tom.
So what's the Sun saying here?
Okay, well, actually, right, so the Sun's got a story on a Brit, an elderly 74-year-old chap who's facing 350 lashes in Saudi Arabia because he was caught with homemade wine, which is a horrible story. There's an awful lot that's been going on in the past couple of weeks. Saudi Arabia has been in the news an awful lot for their human rights breach and whatnot. It's really interesting, though, reading this story and then looking at the Times front page. And they've got a story about a fight in the cabinet over a £5.9 million deal with Saudi Arabia, which is to provide training needs analysis for the Saudi penal system. So essentially, we're going to be doing some training.
What you're saying is the government are going to lash this man.
That is
they're funding
not
the lashing of this man.
There's a whole load of issues with Saudi Arabia. One of the massive issues as well is that they're a big trading partner for the UK. So it's from the Times story, it sounds like there is let's do this. It's £5.9 million quid, but we do billions of pounds worth of trade with them in general. And there was a fracas. Let's call up Jeremy Clarkson and ask him. whatever the phrase is, there is a fracas within cabinet because a lot of people have huge issues with us doing trade with Saudi Arabia. And the front page of the Sun.
Well, I always found it was very strange, our relationship with Saudi Arabia, given they are funding terrorism. They're funding IS, frankly.
And reportedly.
Well, I mean, it's pretty clear that is happening, and a lot of some of these countries around there. But the fact that we're so close to them, despite the fact they do this, and their human rights abuses so much.
And it's not like there isn't a history of Western countries giving them money and then it coming back to bite them, is there?
No.
No, it's never, ever...
Look at us getting all serious.
I know.
This is
okay. Well, let's make it less serious. This man, 74, he was done for. He was caught with four bottles.
Your opening gambit there is let's make this less serious, and now let's launch into the story of the 74-year-old man who's going to be lashed.
Well, he's going to be lashed 350 times because he was caught with four bottles of wine in a country where alcohol is legal. My point. Doesn't he deserve it? Ultimately, he doesn't deserve being lashed, but that is the rule of the country. You're caught with alcohol. You've lived there for 25 years, mate. You know the score.
Didn't know you were such a sort of rule boy.
Well, I'm not, but the point is, people always complain when people come to our country and then they act in the way of their country and they don't really do our ways. Well, it's got to work two ways, right?
I would never condone any form of corporal capital punishment. However, if it wasn't faces 350 lashes, if it was he faces imprisonment for a decade, I would probably be agreeing with you.
And also, but also, there's more, and you know, there's worse cases than that. There's a 17-year-old kid in Saudi Arabia who's going to be crucified because he went on a protest. Yeah. I mean, really, a man getting lashed. I know he's ill. I appreciate he's ill. But a man being lashed 350 times compared to a man who's literally going to be crucified and die. And I think they did 150 people face the death penalty.
Well, I think 350 lashes, you're unlikely to survive it, especially if you're an elderly chap in
who's got asthma and
depends what he's being lashed with, though. You know, if it was just like a feather duster, he might be all right. Maybe. Although even with that, I reckon after that 350 of anything's going to hurt at some point.
He might.
But you know what I was
feathers
thinking?
Wouldn't hurt.
You said that you know, people come here and we complain about them not adopting.
I mean, I don't say
to
our
culture.
I don't.
No, but
because
but
I'm not
people do.
I'm not a little England.
Of course, people do, but we don't then like strike them 350 times with some kind of weapon.
Gerald Howarth was on the radio this morning. You know, the Tory MP who's on the Saudi Arabia Select Committee. They've got a Select Committee for Saudi Arabia, I think. And he was saying, he was justifying it. He was saying, you know, yes, we have human rights, and should human rights be universal? But their human rights are very different to ours. So we're projecting ours on them.
I'm not saying
I agree with Gerald Howarth, and in fact, I think he's wrong. But he makes the point, which you could say is valid, that actually we're saying that our human rights should be universal, whereas actually different countries have different ways of behaving.
So, like when travel, like you know, kids traveling around Thailand or Vietnam or wherever it is very no to have drugs, and they've found with like a 16th of gold seal or whatever people smoke.
Is this personal
days.
Story?
And then they get put in prison for life, or they're going to get hanged. Always get those two mixed up. Is that you don't think that you think we should go, well, they knew the rules?
No, so I'm not saying. I mean, this guy's lived there for 25 years.
Yeah, so he sort of should know better.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm not saying he deserves 350 lashes, but he knew that the punishment for having that was that. It's not like he's some sort of, like, young lad who's gone there and just not known what the score was. He's lived there for 25 years. And also, he's gone over there and... look, I'm playing devil's advocate here, but he's gone over there to make money, right? He's gone over there, I'm making money in this country, there's a lot more money because it's not a nice place to live, and I'm working on their oil fields, etc., etc. You take the money, but you have to live by their rules, unfortunately. That's the depressing truth about it, right?
What if you're gay?
Well, I wouldn't go to Saudi Arabia, mate.
No,
I mean,
but what if that was the only job offer you'd had in 10 years, and
this
you
is
go?
A, I mean, this
and
is
just by being there, you're breaking the rules. But there's nothing. Even if you don't have sex with another person, but they found out you were gay, then
that really is a sort of.
That is a moral conflict there.
It is a moral conflict, but also probably highly unlikely.
Well, you never know. I know some. I heard a story about someone who went to Dubai to film, and he was, you know, he is gay. And he was just there walking about thinking, I'm breaking the law just by being here. Hmm. Not, he wasn't being sexually active.
My now wife and I got red carded in the Dubai Mall for...
Having sex?
I think we were holding hands, or I think maybe I gave her a peck in the cheek, and we got a red card because we weren't married.
A red? Was, they actually have referees running about in
little black and white outfit.
Yeah. I know a lot of footballers go to Dubai, but what's, you know,
it's the only way of keeping
that's
them in
what,
check.
That's what, unless there is that sort of system, footballers can't go there. That's the international.
I
rules.
Think we should have that. We should bring that into this country. Just like when people
just for
do.
Just me and my wife.
Well,
no,
just
no,
like,
no,
you remember
else.
When you were at the swimming bars as a kid and you did it and someone just blew a whistle and you immediately like reacted to that and went, oh, I've been told off. We should have that like in the street.
Well, but
we
sort of do.
Like old
but,
bobbies.
Know, but you know, we learn on roads where they've said we're not going to have speed cameras, but what we'll do is we'll flash up your speed and then
they
say slow
that.
Down, buddy.
They
like,
do
I,
that
I,
in
I
America,
do that. I respond to that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Another story that's big in today's papers, we've touched upon it in the intro, is. Tom Watson, he's under fire. What, Dan? What's Tom Watson been doing?
Well, so he got some. I don't know who told him or who said to him. Look, I think Lord Britain had, you know, abused or raped some underage people back in the day. Anyway, he got this information and thought, well, I've got this information. I'm not going to sit on it. I'm going to tell people. And it turned out that he didn't do what people had alleged. Now the thing, and now everyone's going, you shouldn't have said anything because now his reputation's tarnished and everything. I've always thought that with anything to do with sexual, you know, assault, because it's the one thing where when you get accused of it, even if you turn out to be innocent, it still sticks on you. That and
you think that they should be. You think that
even more than
you
murder.
You think that those people who are accused should remain innocent. Should remain anonymous. Sorry.
Yeah, they should remain innocent. But just not do it in the first place.
But if you take your point to another level, that would have meant that Rolf Harris was still wandering around. The only reason Rolf Harris is now serving time is because he was named publicly. It led to other people coming forward and saying he did it to me too, and that is why he's now in prison.
Okay, so you've got a personal vendetta against Rolf Harris because of
he touched me didgeridoo.
Okay. There's an example where it worked, but I think there's many more examples where people. Anyway, look, I'm not like harshly. I don't stand really strongly on that opinion. I just think that it's definitely a conversation.
It's a very tricky point.
But if you think that you've got information that should be passed on, do you do something about it? Well, I think you do. Like,
yeah, Tom Watson's being held up here for reporting what he believes to be a rape. Now, he did it in probably a clumsy way,
yeah,
but that is because Tom Watson is a clumsy man. Yeah. I mean, no, he's a clumsy politician. He's a clumsy human being.
But there are a couple of other issues with it. It's not just the clumsy way in which he did it, which wasn't just clumsy. You know, there was a big first person piece in the Mirror. He said he was close to evil or something. That was a quote by one of the alleged victims, Jane, and then he wrote that quote again in a piece that he wrote. And the question around Tom Watson, which is why it's getting a lot of play out, is this politically motivated? Because a lot of the people that he drew attention to, Leon Britton, for example. Tories. Greville Janner, he was less vocal on. He was obviously a Labour peer.
Yeah.
So a lot of the reason why he's getting.
It's not like Tom Watson to be tribal towards Labour, is it?
I
find quite amusing is obviously the Daily Mail have gone for him in there for Tom Watson today, a really big time. That will partly be driven by the fact that A, he's Labour, and B, he also was very vocal against newspapers and drove the Leveson inquiry and investigation into News International, et cetera, and wanted, you know, to bring about a sort of royal charter on press to curtail press freedoms, the Mail would say it. And so now they're sort of going big for it against him and saying, oh, he shouldn't have done that, you know, should he have reported this, should he have... About 3 weeks ago, they were writing lots of front pages about the VIP sex scandal and how it was, you know, there was something that went deep.
Yeah. But this goes back to the issue that people aren't having a go at reporting this. That's absolutely fine. But when you're writing big open editorials about it, when you're writing first person pieces about it, and you're adopting it and you're championing it, then you're going above the bar of...
Well, he's basically done the wrong thing and the right thing at the same time.
Yeah, and the problem is then the pendulum swings. Yeah. You know, now we've got the problem with, well, will victims now come forward because they've seen everyone so much slack?
Well, if anyone can see it out, it will be Tom Watson. He's known for his bullish qualities, and I suspect he doesn't really care what the papers are necessarily saying about. I have.
Have you?
Yeah. Because obviously he drove the News of the World, Guardian stuff that he was driving there, the News of the World. I once went to the V Festival after the News of the World had shut down.
I didn't see this coming.
And I saw Tom Watson in the VIP area, so I thought this will be amusing. So I tweeted him to say, "I do hope you're going to be declaring the fact that you're in the VIP area at the V Festival." And I didn't have a picture on my Twitter at that point, and I just saw him look at his phone and then just stand up and look around to see who'd been tweeting him. So and then I went up to him and said hello, and he said he'd agree to do an interview with me, and he hasn't since.
So the moral of the story is, if you're listening to this, never agree to an interview with Tom Latcham.
Yeah. Otherwise,
or unless you're ready to do it, because he will hound you for that 4 years ago. You're still moaning about it.
You saw him at V Festival, I thought you were going to say something like, you know, I was really off my head and he refused to give me a massage. You know.
No, also he was wearing winkle pickers, and I tell you what, that is a hanging offence. So
not with boot cut jeans as well, because that combo is always...
No, I think he was wearing, like, you know, them really bad sort of Lonsdale slip-ons?
Yeah.
Yeah. There you go.
Let's judge a man on his fashion.
That's a crucifying offence.
That's definitely the way to do it.
That's a crucifying offence. Right, Paul, let's play your first song, Ludovico Einaudi. How do you pronounce that?
Do you know, right, can I caveat this with, right, any time when you listen to Desert Island Discs and you have someone on there and they'll play something fancy or something, or classical or anything, and you think, you never listen to that. You're lying to make yourself sound clever.
So this is the one you've lied about.
So this is the one I've lied about. Except for, here is my top 25 playlist on my
Spotify. Where is
which
it?
You,
there,
which he's played, which he's played 30 times last night.
Can I take the backstory to it quickly before we put it on?
Yep.
So my wife and I have a son. We brought him home from hospital in February 2 years ago, and it was freezing cold, and I bought a new car for it, and I was all really excited about bringing him home.
Were
and
you
was...
allowed to bring him home?
This
She gave birth to him, right?
She did. She did. Yeah, it wasn't okay. Someone else's. I'll take that one. And it was snowing, and I brought the car around, I had the heating on and everything, and I put on like soft music, so I read somewhere you were meant to do that. And this was a song that was playing as we drove Seb home, who Tom brought for his first pint, by the way.
It was a touching story until you said that I took your 4 month old son out drinking.
And he still calls it the sleepy song whenever he hears it now. And we get in the car, he calls it the sleepy
song.
So
that's because he was drunk.
Night, night, Seb. This is Fubar Radio. It's 10:29. No, that's not Classic FM. It's it's FUBAR Radio. An unlikely choice by Paul McNamara, but his choice all the same.
I liked it. Okay, I'm going out there and saying it.
Excellent. Yeah,
I do actually like a bit of classical music. As I've got older, I've realised that I've got to this weird point where I start finding.
How old are you, Dan?
What?
How old are you, Dan?
24.
Absolutely. 39.
So you're not in the FUBAR demographic, mate. So
I'm 39, and your tastes do start changing. Indeed.
That is the voice of Dan Clark there, stand-up comic, and my co-presenter today for a brief while until I boot him out because he likes classical music. Anyway, the other story that I introed the show on was Julian Assange, who effectively the police yesterday said they were withdrawing the watch they've been putting on him since June 2012, which has cost £12 million.
£12 million watch?
Yes, very good. But someone who's been very outspoken about it is Baroness Jones, who's a Green peer who scrutinises the work of the Met, and she joins us on the line. Hello, Jenny, you all right?
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. You've been very outspoken about this. You say in the Mail today, why have we wasted so much valuable police time and taxpayers' money keeping one man trapped in an embassy when using covert surveillance was always an option? Who's to blame?
Well, this is a difficult question because it's obviously, to some extent, it's the Met Police because they made the decision about how to make sure that he couldn't escape. But at the same time, the government has obviously put a lot of pressure on the Met to make sure that he didn't escape. And so, I think I'd blame the government. That's my default.
And should there be any? I mean, that's often your default for a lot of things, Jenny. But what do you think that should be done about this, or are we just going to write it off and consign it to history?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure yet if the government has paid the Met for that sort of police cover, because the idea was that when it's a national issue, the government should pay the Met some top up. And obviously, the Met is struggling at the moment because there's been so many budget cuts. And so I am going to find out if the government has paid. Secondly, I'm not a big fan of covert surveillance anyway, so I will be interested to find out if all the covert surveillance is legal, because some of what they do is illegal. And I suppose thirdly, I do welcome it, because those police officers have been kept away from all sorts of much more useful work in the boroughs, on the streets, talking to communities. And so really, I think all in all, it's been the most ridiculous standoff for all these years and for such a huge amount of money.
Yeah. Hi, Jenny. I'm Paul McNamara. I'm a journalist at Channel 4 News. I'm with Tom today. I've got one question for you. Do you guys get to see like a breakdown of where the money's gone? Because £12.6 million sounds like a huge amount. It's £4.2 million a year. And it's a couple of bobbies outside, right? How does it cost £4.2 million a year to have two people outside 24/7? It's like £700,000 an officer.
There are several aspects to it, but essentially, although, was it really only two officers? Because at times it was more than that, and they would be armed officers, so they're highly skilled. And of course, there's all the backup that they need. Plus, there's the on cost, as it were, where they could have been elsewhere covering other areas. So some people perhaps have been paid overtime for covering those officers who've been standing outside the embassy. I have no trouble at all in believing it's 12 million. In the terms of the police budget, which of course is billions, then 12 million doesn't sound very much. But as you say, it's several police officers who could have been doing better things.
Sounds huge.
Jenny Jones, thank you for joining us, Jenny. That is Jenny Jones, who is the Baroness for
Green
Party.
Doesn't Tony Blair have a policeman still standing outside his house?
Former Prime Ministers do.
And Northern Ireland ministers. Did that still happen? I don't know if it still does. Yeah, Northern Ireland ministers. I got a mate whose dad was a security minister, and he's been on the show before, Lord West, and he lives just in a house in the East End. And we used to go around to his house. It's a fairly sort of nondescript house, and I'd say to him, you're the security minister. Shouldn't there be like a guard like watching? He went, how do you know there isn't? They're doing their job properly, right? Because they're hidden.
I've got a quick idea, right? There's a lot of homeless people. They're used to being outside, just sat. Why not just put them in a Bobby's uniform outside Tony Blair's, and then we're saving a bit of cash on someone that I don't think people necessarily
are that bothered about him being protected. How do you know they haven't already done it and just didn't tell us?
Because I go there every day, and he looks well shaved. and well groomed.
Yeah, well, you can tell if someone's homeless.
Yeah.
Properly homeless. I actually once did a feature for the Mirror where when I was in Ireland, where they asked me to go and beg on the streets of Dublin for a day, and it was freezing. And I got up. I didn't have a shower. I pulled on my clothes. But the problem is, I look far too well fed for a homeless person, and no one gave any money. Right, for ages, I was sat on this really cold bridge. No one gave me money until the photographer turned up, and then everyone gave money. Wow. And in about 2 hours I'd made about €8, but I was so, and I got moved on by the police, and then I was so bored and cold that I went, I'm gonna go and sit in a cafe and stick money in myself. So I was like putting in about €20.
I love this. And then everyone gave money. I made €8. Oh, yeah. They didn't give me that much money.
That's my blag. Actually, that's one of my many blags. I blagged the news desk by pretending I'd been there all day when in fact I'd actually paid money to go and sit at home.
Always on the fiddle.
You don't know the half of it, Clark. So let's some lighter stories. I mean, we say lighter stories. Paul, you want to talk about Europe?
I don't want to talk about Europe. This is how light it gets at Channel 4 News. The only thing I want to draw about Euro, this happens all the time whenever there's something like this, and they sit around and think, who can we get that can connect with the young people? Who can... I've got it. I know. June Sarpong of T4 fame. The lady who used to sit next to Vernon Kay, that's the one. Bring her in.
Vernon Kay was
too
busy.
She'll be great.
Vernon Kay is actually a virulent anti-European voice.
So what they actually mean is, who do we get to speak to the ex-young people?
I'm an ex-young person.
Yeah, we all are.
I am now swayed by Jude Sarpong.
Yeah. Talking about ex-young people, this is a perfect link. I really should get a noise when I do a link that's really good.
Like a bell.
Rather than saying, that was a great link. Yeah. I should get a noise that goes yeah,
or like that. Anyway, just talk for a minute about how great it was.
Well, that's what I do. A noise would be better. Anyway, talking of former young people, the Rolling Stones.
I love this story.
That could have been anyone, though. You do know that, don't you? So I don't know if that was a good link.
All right, I'll take the noise back.
Right, I love this story for a number of reasons. So this is the writer of the Rolling Stones. TMZ in America got it. And hot on the list of what the Rolling Stones need now whenever they check into a hotel is a little instruction on how the TV works, which is nice. Aww. But the thing I love most about this story is how it's been written up in the Times. So they go over all of it and then down the bottom they go, nevertheless, they still have the power to shock. The comedian... Mark Maron met Richards recently at the studios of National Public Radio, a bastion of decency and upright living. He noted that the room where they meet was stocked with miniature vodkas and orange soda.
Oh, edgy.
Well, there we go. He's having a vodka and orange.
They've still got it.
That everyone knows about the Rolling Stones.
Although their rider does say that they must have access to alcohol 24 hours a day, even if the bar closes, and if the hotel's unable to provide it, then it has to make other arrangements.
Isn't that just a hotel bar?
Yeah.
Isn't that just what hotel bars do? Room service.
Also,
they want room service.
They wanted the after hours dry cleaning. So they don't have to wait until the morning to get their clothes back.
Wow.
Big time.
Have they only got one set of clothes, the Rolling Stones? And also, they asked for blacked out windows so they can party as late as they like without being spied upon. When he was caught with that ballerina, he was on a balcony, wasn't he?
So when they don't throw TVs out the window anymore, obviously.
They want to make sure they work.
Yeah.
That's what they really want.
How does this work? I've never done an impression of Mick Jagger,
It's like he's here in the room.
Party piece, I love it.
Actually, maybe you should come back on again, Dan, some impressions, and we can pretend that we've got like real people.
Yeah,
here.
What are you saying?
Was Eamon Holmes?
What are you saying?
You're a real person.
Did Eamon Holmes ever actually do this show, or was it just you?
Has anybody actually done this show?
Yeah.
Oh,
well,
no wonder I get so many news lines.
Is there anybody out there?
Andy Burnham tweeted, "Go, I've never heard who's talking."
I write it on. No wonder I get so many news lines. Dan, finally in the sort of light section, there's a story in The Sun today that's caught your eye, has it?
Well, a hospital was discovered to have served up a plate of food that on the same plate had chicken curry and rice and a summer fruit crumble.
I mean, I don't know about you, but I read that story and thought, that looks delicious.
Well, it, to me, it looks better if you look at the... It's on page 17 if you happen to have a sun in front of you or you want to see the picture. It looks better than it sounds. But the thing is they're saying that like that's a bad thing. But I think just serving someone what looks like a sort of heated up microwave chicken curry and rice to anyone who's lying in a hospital bed is probably not a great thing in the first place. You know, like, I'm not sure that any... That's really like, okay, you're recovering. We're just going to give you something really unhealthy.
My favourite thing about it, though, is the comment from the hospital down at the bottom. I mean, say, if you see the picture, it's the... Regardless of how many plates it's on, it's not the most appetising food in the world. And at the bottom they say, clearly this was a mistake and did not meet the high standards that our patients expect or deserve. But if you put that on two separate plates, then all's
then
forgiven,
fine.
Right? That's the high standards that we all expect.
Or just a split plate.
People are paying, like, seriously big money to have that at Heston Blumenthal's restaurant. So, like, they should
fusion.
Be lucky.
It's fusion food.
Fusion
food. Listen, Paul, it's been lovely to have you. Thanks for joining us. Will you come on again?
Shouldn't have thought so.
Right, okay. Well, that was good because you were rubbish.
You should never ask that question.
Oh, right, you have to demand it.
Yeah, well, no.
Right. You're coming on again.
I didn't want to say yes and then have you moan at 4 years like you have about Tom Watson about not coming on the show again. I'll never like that Paul McNamara.
And he wears Winkle Pickers and Lonsdale pull-ons. So we'll play you out with your... Dan Clark's going to stay with us. Are you? You are?
Yes. Yeah, I'm feeling it.
Fine. Okay. And we're going to talk some fun stories that we've noticed and things that we want to talk about in the next sort of half hour. And then we've got plenty on. Actually, Paul, before you go, have you ever pulled a blag? You know, there was a guy in the Merseyside derby pretended to be in a wheelchair so we could get have you ever pulled a blag?
I pretended to be your friend for 10 years so that I could be on this radio show.
There we go.
That's the long game.
That is the long game. Well done. Game. Good blag.
Was it worth it?
No.
Right. We'll play you out. It's your second song, Talking Heads. This Must Be the Place. How about that, Paul?
Yeah. That's it.
And where can people follow you on Twitter?
They can follow... You can join the other 12 people... PG McNamara. Where it happens.
Well, it's been a joy having you, and thank you, and I'll see you again soon when we go and get your baby good and drunk.
He deserves it. Thank you.
Latcham on FIBA Radio.
Hello, it's Tom Latcham here, and I'm still with Dan Clark. He hasn't disappeared off. Comedian, stand-up comedian and actor, Dan Clark. He hasn't
decided to commit.
Yeah, well done. I'm glad you did, because otherwise I'm talking to myself now about stuff. But we were asking you at the start, the question of the day was, what blags have you ever carried out? Because able-bodied Liverpool fan Jake Danner, it was reported yesterday, pretended to be in a wheelchair to get into the Merseyside derby, and he was sort of held up as a pariah. We wanted to know, what tricks and blags have you ever pulled? With Tom at foobarradio.com on the email, or tweet us at foobarradio. We've had a few come in. One from Clementine says, I dug out some old crutches and bandaged up my leg to avoid queuing for X Factor live shows. It didn't work, and instead of avoiding queuing, I ended up queuing on one leg for about an hour. Also, was not used to being on crutches and fell down a slight flight of stairs. Whoops. Rachel says, pretended to be pregnant to get a stick on the tube, tried to shove a scarf up my jumper, plan failed as I was horrifically hungover and stank of wine. And Sophie finally says, we tried to pretend our mate was a member of the Australian Paralympic football squad to get into the showing of the Olympic opening ceremony in Victoria Park. We said he was dyslexic, and as they were turning us down, he bleated, I can't even read. Terrible scenes. I was saying what blag I'd done. I once pretended to have a delivery when I was at the News of the World. I once pretended to have a delivery for a convicted killer, because I had to prove his that it was the correct person, it was his identity. So I took along this box to his house. I can't remember what was in the box, something really rubbish, yeah. I'm pretty sure, and sort of knocked on his door, and I can tell my legs were shaking. I was like really nervous, because you know, he was mentally a killer. He basically, the story was that he'd been allowed to drive a cab again, even though he'd been in prison and killed his wife, etc. So I wanted to prove it was him, and I had to get him to sign it and print his name on this thing, and I was like sort of stood at the door like terrified, pretending to be a delivery driver. So that's the
that was literally just to prove it was him. You weren't like trying to get any other
information. No, because you don't want to print a photo of somebody who it isn't and say that they're a convicted killer.
That's true.
It's pretty bad as a libel.
What cracked me up about this story with the football fan was like how outraged people were. And yet, in Britain's best loved sitcom, Only Fools and Horses, Del Boy was always sticking disabled signs in his car so that he could park anywhere. It's like, cheeky chappy. But when someone does it for real, it's like, we hate you. It's like, it's the weirdest sort of double standards that people have about that sort of thing.
And you always see footballers parking in disabled bays, or Danny Dyer, I think, did it the other day, and everyone goes mad at him.
Many ways he is, but
in many ways he is what? I couldn't possibly say. He works for a soap that I often write stuff about. So
okay.
Danny Dyer's a perfectly able-bodied man.
Yeah, no, he's. I'm gently obsessed with Danny Dyer. Like I think
Are
many
you?
People. Yeah, just there's something fascinating. People that have, no matter what their because he's sort of generally a good, well-intentioned human. But he has that sort of lack of self-awareness thing. There's something quite sweet about him in a way.
Do you not
way.
Think he is aware of what he's doing? I mean, because I've seen him, there's a sort of clip that he did before EastEnders where him and Daniel Radcliffe were sort of pretending to be Shakespearean actors.
Yeah.
But then every time he'd go through halfway, you know, like do a sort of Shakespearean speech, he'd then go, come on in, you slag!
Yeah.
And like headbutt someone, you know. So he's sort of, he's sending himself up.
Yeah,
sort of
okay.
A bit of a joke.
He is aware to that extent. But it's that hard man thing where, when he used to do those documentaries about gangsters, he was always like, the whole point was that he, you know, admired that sort of culture and sort of wanted to be it. And the amount of times he's like, I am absolutely shitting myself right now. I want a scarper. And it's like, he's so not the man he kind of wishes he was, really, you know.
So he's, what you're saying is he's been carrying out a 15-year blag.
Yeah, there you go. Tie that in.
More of your blags, please. Tom at foodbarradio.com or tweet us at foodbarradio. Dan, is there anything that you would like to talk about that's tickled your interest that you thought, I must talk about this on the radio?
No.
Okay, fine. That's a section over.
Yeah. there's a few things, but I, you know, just, I know this is really sort of a boring subject, but because
great,
Paul brought it up, I just, you know, so the EU thing's happening at the moment, huge stuff, right? And I genuinely don't believe that the members of the public, including myself, really know what the difference between staying in the EU is and leaving.
No.
So and it's being talked about all the time, but if you asked anyone what are the pros and cons,
and that's kind of the problem.
Yeah.
No, and but also even if you were to let out, everyone's got an agenda. Everyone can find a stat about anything. And the point is no one actually really knows. No.
But we are going to be the ones that vote for it.
We are. So, but no one knew about Scotland either, did they? And
I think Scottish people knew, didn't they?
No, but they don't, do you? You don't really? Know. You're kind of told all these stats. And actually what they're saying is some of the papers today about the staying in campaign, which was launched yesterday, is that it's...
By June Sarpong,
God bless her, is... She knows.
Of course she knows.
Why wouldn't she know? But basically, they're saying it's the politics of fear, which worked quite well with the Scottish election. You know, if you leave the EU, there will be more crime. We won't be able to, cooperate with other European countries, so there'll be more crime and a top police.
We won't get those brilliant Belgian police coming over and arresting people.
Yeah, the twins, the Thompson twins, and things like it will lose 3 million jobs, which is what Stuart Rose, the former head of M&S, said, and things like that. But it's sort of trying to scare people into doing it. And it works in Scotland. What I personally think is nobody knows. And so kind of it's okay not to know. It's like with the Greek financial crisis. We had someone on and a financial expert. And she went, look, I don't know either. No one knows. And that's kind of the point. But it's okay to have an opinion. What my fear is if we leave the EU is that it's kind of just... It's just showing us to be little Englanders on a sort of international stage, and I just don't know. I don't know that retreating in a global age is necessarily the right move.
At the moment, from the little I know about it, it's almost like at the moment we've got our cake and eat it because we're not as embedded into the EU as other countries are. We've still got some level of independence, but it's so we've sort of got the best of both worlds, and yet it's still not good enough for some people. And I think you're right. I think there is a little sense of we don't need everybody else. But actually, if that happened, it's like we're not that superpower we once were.
No.
We're just going to be like
I think perhaps be careful what you wish for is the only, I mean, and ultimately,
even though normally I do listen to everything Nigel Farage says, I am on this one instance kind of thinking maybe
I've spent a day with Nigel Farage.
How was it?
I think
he's amazing.
Interesting.
I love that there being public figures like that because it makes everything that much more interesting.
Well, when I met him, he was very off-guarded.
Was he?
And was talking quite openly about things perhaps that he shouldn't have been telling a tabloid journalist about. But this is in 2006. I won't say what they were.
Please?
No, not on air. I'll tell you afterwards. But then I've met him since because one of my friends is his head of press.
Right.
And he is completely different now. I mean, I don't know what he's like since UKIP became...
Yeah.
Rubbish and nothing and pointless since the election, but before the election, and it was just sort of like you're chatting to him, and he just sort of parrots the same line.
Yeah.
And I just thought it must be so boring to be you. Like, you know, you can't say anything, you can't let your guard down, you always have to be on, and you always have to be saying the same message over and over again. That's why I wouldn't make a very good politician. I mean, it's one of many reasons why I wouldn't make a particularly good politician.
My favourite thing about him is, for some reason, he thinks, and it probably works to an extent, that being seen drinking booze all the time somehow makes him relatable and like one of the people. But I just can't help but think, first of all, are you going to be pissed when you're, like, fingers hovering over the red button? Or are you going to have a heart attack, you know, yeah. 2 weeks into being, you know, Prime Minister.
I mean, you don't want a pissed someone who dislikes foreigners.
No, you really don't.
In charge of any buttons, really. But yes. So anyway, let's play one of your songs, Dan, and then we'll come back and we'll talk a bit more of other light stories. How about Waterfall by the Stone Roses? One of my favourite bands.
Oh yeah,
yeah. Let's play that. Okay,
I've got a reason why I picked that.
Well, say it then.
Well, that was because when we met before, we did touch upon. Sort of early 90s counterculture, which I think is something we're both like fascinated with.
How
counterculture has changed over the years. And you said that you'd gone to one of the reunion gigs
loved. Manchester, yeah.
But when I watched the Shane Meadows film on this, I always liked the Stone Roses, but there was something about this bit where they're rehearsing this song. It's the first time they rehearse together, and it just was so feel good, spine tingling.
Yeah, it
was such a good moment. So I thought I'd play this for you and me, really.
Thank you.
All right.
On FIBA Radio.
Hello, it's 11:06. We're into the second of 2 hours now in this new formatted, shortened show of mine on a Tuesday morning, 10 till 12. And I'm joined, delighted to say, still by my co-presenter, Dan Clark, comedian and actor. Hello, my friend. Coming up later this hour, we're going to be talking to Matthew Small, who's an author whose new book, takes a look at poverty, compares poverty in India and in England, in his hometown of Bath. We'll also be talking to James Montague, who's a world football expert, about the internationals at the weekend, but also Serbia and Albania, which caused an international incident when someone flew a drone with a flag into the stadium and caused a riot. He has interviewed the man who flew that drone, so he'll be telling us a little bit about that later, and we'll also have a little business section. But as we are, you're still here with us, Dan. I mean, we're talking about other things. Stone Roses there. Mm.
What was it like when you went to see them in the...
In Manchester, I went twice.
Yeah.
In Manchester, it was great because it was a real feel-good vibe. Everyone was in such a great mood. I think I maybe saw one bit of trouble, which when you think about 75,000 people all drunk or whatever in a field, there wasn't any trouble. You could take beers in. It was like they're almost searching you.
It was great.
It was such a great night. And then we went on to like a Factory Records night six in the morning, and everyone was in such a good mood. Then I went to one in Finsbury Park, and it was just full of football hooligans just all mooching around in mobs and stuff. And apparently, well, I just didn't enjoy it. Didn't like the vibe as much. And crime in Finsbury Park, which is already quite an area of high crime, went up by 150% that weekend. So, So it tells you what the vibe was like there in Finsbury Park.
I always find it bizarre when people want to go to a concert, like a music place, which is a thing of joy, to start fights and things. Like, it's always...
Well, I was talking about this. I like happy hardcore and have done for many, many years. And we were talking about that in the Edinburgh show. And someone said, we were talking about a rave the other day, me and a friend, and they were saying, she was saying she saved someone from being really badly beaten up. Another time, she like was saved by a guy who had a huge shard of glass who'd taken it in to stab someone.
Yeah.
And I'm like, when I was going to hardcore raves, and it was all like happy hardcore, hands in the air, last thing on my mind was fighting, really. It was, you know, you were...
It is weird. I do think back on, and, you know, my girlfriend often says that I am too nostalgic, and that I sound old so often.
Yes.
But I am kind of... I have started to feel like when you look back at the 90s, it was a bit of a golden time to grow up. Mm. Like, probably like in the 60s or whatever, in that there was very, very little wrong in the world. It was quite a party decade where everyone was just sort of having a good time.
Yeah.
I almost feel guilty for like teenagers now who grow up in just a time of constant doom.
Everybody always says that.
Do they?
You're basically sounding like our dads.
But when you look at like the economy or wars or just the attitude towards politics and things, there was definitely a more positive, like a good eight. I know the beginning of the decade had like the first Iraq war, but there was a good 7 or 8 years where it was just everyone's, and you know, people were borrowing a lot of money and everyone owned a house even though they couldn't afford it, but so obviously it came back to bite everyone. But it was there was quite a long period of time where there wasn't that sense of doom or that life was really, really hard.
And also it's difficult, sort of countercultures, which we touched upon in Edinburgh, the internet, the heralding of the internet. If you think about it, right, when was Napster invented? About 2001, I think. Hasn't really been a counterculture since the early 2000s. You know, the last one was probably Garage.
Grime, I guess people talk about.
Grime, but I mean, because there's so much, you can get everything anywhere, now with the internet. And so it's very difficult. You know, before it used to be you'd pass around a tape at school, which is where happy hardcore, you know. I mean, I used to listen to tape packs when I was at secondary school because people would be like, oh, I've got my sister's tape pack, you know. And you'd be like,
is happy hardcore like Charlie Says, that kind of thing? Or is that more rave?
Yeah. I mean, that's all in that sort of field.
Field, good pun.
It's all in that field, yeah. So sort of breakbeat, breakbeat and
I'm
sort
just
of
full
beat, happy pianos, that sort of stuff. Happy lyrics, it's really great stuff. I mean, it's overrated actually. I was listening to a song the other day, was on the way home and I was in a good mood. I was in the car and I was just dancing away to it. And there's a song from like...
You were dancing in a car?
Yeah, I was driving.
As you were driving?
I was going mad for it. And there was a song from like 94, I think, or 95.
Doing backspins.
I think it was called Elation, the Anthem. And it's so basic. And actually underneath it on YouTube, the person who made the song goes, I made this on an Atari DAT machine in my kitchen. And you're like, it's so raw. It's such a great song, but it's so raw. It's so basic. It's made on a DAT machine. It actually, in many ways, I find, is better than music these days, which is made using huge technological kits, computers, and all that stuff. It doesn't have that same rawness. And you look at films, CGI does not make a film good, actually.
It does not make
a good film. But, you know, you look at, say, Hook, right? Hook was incredible. Mm. Hook was fantastic, and it didn't really have much CGI. The Goonies, no CGI, wonderful film where you go inside it because the set's so incredible. Now with the CGI, I just think you can make it look amazing, but we know it's not real. And that, for me, lessons.
Again, we're going to start sounding really old, but... I agree. Like, I go and see something like The Avengers, and I will watch... I embrace all genres and things, but it's like watching just an assault of like effects. It's like there's nothing to sort of like latch onto and go, that's... But the other thing about the counterculture thing is there used to be a time where a scene would happen for like 2 years before anyone would hear of it, like in Bristol with Trip Hop and Manchester with Magister and Seattle. And now it's like if the second something's happening, which... I don't know if it ever is anyway, but...
Well, I mean, it's not happening for us, mate.
No, it isn't. But what is that scene that then becomes, you know, commercialised and sold around the world? Because they were literally... I was watching a documentary about the grunge era as well, and the only reason Seattle created a scene is because they were saying... I think it was a Dave Grohl documentary he did about different cities and their music scenes. And they were saying it was just because it was so up on the far left of the United States that bands used to just ignore it on tours because it was too far out of the way to go. And they were sick of always missing out, or that you'd have to drive 12 hours to go and see one of your favourite bands. So they just started like doing it themselves.
Wow.
And I just don't think you'd ever get that spirit or that sense of culture now, because you don't need that. You can put it online for everyone to see it. But, you know, that's good in many ways. But it's also like that feeling of something happening from the grassroots up and developing for a few years. I don't know if that will ever happen again.
No, I don't think it probably will. How sad.
Oh, well.
There's a talking about what happens on the internet. There's a story that I wanted to touch on, and there's a reason, because there's something that's happened in my life recently. There's a woman here who says that she handed her husband from Kenya £25,000, then found out he'd got 46 other women across the world. Now, it's obviously very sad for this woman. But my cleaner, and I won't name her because that would be not a nice thing to do, came round to my house the other day. She comes on a Thursday. Doesn't matter. Anyway, she came round recently and she said that she'd been... She'd met a man on Skype, an American man who'd approached her on Skype.
Can I just interject quickly? Like, how do you meet someone on Skype?
I know.
Are you on Skype and then you go, oh,
I mean,
hi,
also,
what's your name?
Also, my cleaner is from Georgia and doesn't speak fantastic English, so I surmised a lot of this, but I believe that he approached her on Skype. And she was like, she was basically talking to me about how she was going to, she's like, I'm going to move to America and have babies with him. My cleaner's like 45. I'm like, you've already got four kids. I don't think that moving to America... And also, they've never met. Anyway, and so he messaged her. I think of you every moment of my life. You're so far away, yet so close in my heart. My heart and my body yearns for you. I love you unconditionally. I accept you and your kids, who will become mine, and any other little ones that have come from us. For the first time, I have purpose. For the first time, I have found someone real. It goes on in that vein.
And what, that's not
a week
all
ago.
Oh my God.
No, and they've had a series of messages between each other. I'll show you the pictures in a minute. And she says, I'm very happy because I met you. I understand why she's so happy, because, you know, her life isn't great, and she wants to meet someone, and I just worried, like, this guy is literally, you met a week ago, and he's already telling you he loves you.
I love you more than
any word can say. I love you more than every action I take. I'll love you till the end, etc., etc.
That is amazing. I'm still confused how you meet a stranger on Skype. Like, surely you can only meet someone who's an email you've got and you call them. Or is it now a social thing? Do you meet...
I don't know. I don't think so. I don't think Skype is. It's very strange. So he's hunting around for a woman on Skype. I don't know. I felt really bad because she was so excited and she was like, "Oh, I've met this guy and I really want to meet. You want to meet someone?" I'm like, just be careful because you literally have no idea who this man is. And I was like, on the plus side, you know, I don't think she's got a great deal of money, so it's not like she's going to give him lots of money. But it's like, just be careful. Be careful with your heart. You know,
Did she say where he was from?
America.
From America. So it's not even like a.
He's 46.
Right.
His name's Andrew, and he's like.
Andy, yes.
You what? 46-year-old Andy from America. You know him.
I went from
you
this
met him
myself.
On Skype.
I met him. He's really charming, I have to say. He did pull the wool over my eyes. No, but he's not even from some like war-torn country that's you know, where he's desperately trying to like, you know, meet someone to get out of his situation.
No, and maybe he is sad and he's had I think she said something like, you know, I don't know. He
actually,
had a tragedy in his life,
quite nice.
So I don't know, it's quite sad, but I was just like, be careful. Just be careful with your heart, because there are crazy people out there, as we all know, who's internet dated.
How do you not like say to yourself, okay, I haven't met him. It's only been a week. How do you go from 0 to 100 like that? What part of desperation?
I mean, because if you really want to believe and you really want something in your life, I mean, I once met a girl on the internet and I'd never met her before, and she, you know, she was, you know, a very attractive girl, and I probably got more carried away than I should. Never met her in the end, but we would talk on the phone, never met her. Had no idea that actually she was the person who was sending the photos. So you can, when you're lonely and you want
to
meet someone, you
Catfish.
I have, yeah.
I think that kind of pretty much.
Well, they tried launching that in the UK, but the thing with America is they're all lunatics. Whereas in the UK,
lunatics.
No, but they launched a pilot and no one would talk.
Really?
Because British people are very different to Americans. They're more reserved. And also, they're not as crazy. I mean, yes, people are crazy, but I think British people just, I don't really want to share this embarrassing moment.
That's the word, share. People like to share. Out there.
They do. Right, we're going to play another one of your songs, then we'll try and get Matthew Small on the phone, who's an author, and we'll talk to him about his book about poverty. How about Ruby Tuesday by the Rolling Stones?
Because it's Tuesday and we've talked about the Rolling Stones.
Wow, what lovely synergy. Well done, Dan Clark.
Thank you.
It's Football Radio, 10:18.
She would never say where she came from. Yesterday don't matter if it's gone. While the sun is bright, or in the darkest night, no one knows. She comes and goes. Why she needs to be so free. She'll tell you it's the only way to be. She just can't be chained to a life where nothing's gained and nothing's lost. At such a cost. There's no time to lose, I heard her say. Catch your dreams before they slip away. Dying all the time, lose your dreams and you may lose your mind. In life unkind. Goodbye, Ruby Tuesday. Who could
It's Tom Latcham. It's 11:21 on Fubar Radio, the UK's home of uncensored, unregulated and ad-free radio. I'm still joined in the studio, thankfully, by my co-presenter, Dan Clark, comedian and actor. He hasn't disappeared off anywhere.
I should promote my tour at some point, I think.
We'll do it now if you want.
All right, yeah. I'm going on tour next Thursday, starting in Leicester at The Cookie, it's called. I don't know what that is.
Very good.
And I'll be playing various states. So you can go on to Dan Clark... we can go on to danclarkcomedy.com or you can go on to livenation.com/Dan Clark, I think, something like that.
How many dates have you got and how long is it spread over?
It's spread over 4 weeks and it's about 20 dates, I think.
So you're not going to be coming home in between?
Yeah, I'll be coming home a lot.
Life on the road doesn't sound as good as...
Do you know what? Now that I try to eat healthily as well, it is an absolute nightmare.
Yeah.
So... out go all the
you are not the Rolling Stones, you are the opposite of Rolling Stones. Well, I must have dry cleaning at all times
all
of the
times.
Day that's on my rider,
and a kale smoothie.
What does poverty mean today? In his new book Down and Out today, writer Matthew Small seeks to answer this question by looking at similarities and differences between poverty in the UK and India, and he joins us now on the line on Skype. Are you there?
I am, and yes.
Hello, Matthew, how are you?
Hi, very well, thank you.
Good man, thanks for joining us. So, your book compares UK and India. Why did you decide that those two places would be a good good two places to compare and contrast?
Firstly, it's something when I began to write the book is where do you begin? Is something with poverty, because it's everywhere and it's all around us. So really, choosing India, it was something actually, because when we think about poverty for a long time, we can see and we think about extreme poverty, which is, of course, is something that we can associate with India. And actually, what was an interesting idea behind the book was also to look at the similarities between the cultures and to explore poverty in that way. And of course, so when I arrived in India, there was, of course, extreme poverty, but also what was very interesting was similarities between sort of young people in Mumbai struggling to afford rent, and without the rental, struggling to find employment, and actually then looking back to our own culture and seeing those similarities at the same time.
And so what were the... I mean, you've expressed some of the similarities there. What were the differences? I imagine they're pretty obvious, the differences.
Well, I mean, the differences, of course, is when you do see sort of going into a city like Mumbai with slums and the extreme poverty with... For instance, in the book, I mentioned the experience of walking one evening and then all of a sudden passing a baby boy and a little girl on the street and looking around for their parents and having no idea, you know. Of course, their parents may well have been nearby selling or begging, but at that time they were just two young children on a dark street. And it's basically, that's obviously something that you don't see or so much of at all in our country. But it's quite shocking when you do see sort of come across that experience.
You compared Mumbai with Bath, and I can't imagine that they're particularly similar. Why Bath?
Well, Bath is actually, to a large extent, the reason why I began the book in Bath. It's where, for the most part of my adult life, I've lived. And actually, when you look at Bath on the surface, you see wealth, you see affluence, and you think of a heritage city. And actually, what was the interesting is I began to look into the city and try and engage with some of the charities working with young homeless or with people in vulnerable situations, are actually the undercurrent of poverty that exists in that region and across, generally across the whole of the UK, in that area where there is a growing need for food banks. There's a rise in rough sleepers, and it's basically trying to look into that and trying to find out the roots of that. And of course, it's very hard because each individual person falls into poverty in a different way, but there's also systemic issues that underlie these reasons as well.
It's funny, isn't it, like the food bank thing, because when you live in somewhere like London, you just don't really see this kind of thing so much, and you hear about these statistics, and when you don't see it, you just sort of presume it doesn't exist, you know?
Yeah, it's true. I mean, even when I met the coordinator of the Bar Food Bank, she was retelling the story of when they first started collecting at some of the local supermarkets, and people would come up to them and they'd be like, you know, well, this is Bath, why do we need a food bank here? And it's generally that perception. Of course, it's poverty for the nature is that it can be quite hidden,
and Bath's quite a middle class town, isn't it?
It's quite middle class, to be honest. It's quite affluent as well. It's quite an expensive, like London, it's quite an expensive place to live. But actually, in and around Bath, there's areas, for instance, Twerton, and these areas around Bath, which are actually some of the most deprived in the UK. Mm. And so there's this real, you know, there's this real, and that's another thing in the book, is which is drawing on this thing now about the inequality in the UK and the real divide and the you know, the wealth inequality. And so it's just basically trying to build a narrative and trying to meet with it in what way I can.
And so, and so, how did you? What did you, what conclusions did you surmise? I mean, you know, you were looking to what was keeping people down, what's pushing people down, and how can we move forward? Did you find? Yeah. Did you come up with a solution? Because if you did, you could probably get rich.
I could probably be very rich. I think to come out there, the intention of the book is obviously to explore that, and it's first the primary thing is actually to meet with it, and you know, there's a. As you said before, it can be very, you know, it can be very easy actually to go along our daily life and not to meet with it. And then to also we have to our lives to live. And so the primary thing is actually this idea of seeing this aspect of poverty in society. And then of course there is actually things on a societal level that can be done. For instance, there's a lot of people saying that the way that austerity is happening in the UK is that the most vulnerable people are being hit the hardest, and I think that can be shown in the rise of food banks, in the rise of rough sleepers in the UK over the last. It was, I think the last statistic I saw was that there was 55% more rough sleepers in the UK since 2010. Wow. And so that's a massive rise, and when you look on a rise of that scale, then that really does show up that there's something within the society, within the systems, and within, you know, within the way the culture is run.
I think the other thing is poverty doesn't necessarily have the same aesthetic as it used to. And there's, you know, Alan Sugar said this thing about there are no more poor people in the UK because everyone has a mobile phone, which is a ridiculous thing to say. But also, when a lot of those refugees were coming over, people were going, well, they don't look really desperate. They've all got clothes and some of them have got mobiles. And the thing is back in the day, being poor meant you literally couldn't afford the things
in
the middle.
Nobody had a mobile phone. Yeah. They had your shitty computers.
Yeah. But also, it's like I remember when the recession happened in 2008 and people were talking about it being as big as the Great Depression. And you kind of imagine, well, then that must mean there's like queues of people waiting to get soup from, you know.
Yeah.
But it just doesn't have the same. People can still look like they have things, you know, material things, and that confuses people about what is poor and what isn't.
And of course, you know, that whole idea is actually, you know, when we look at poverty, what do we look at? Do we look at poverty of financial poverty, or do we look at, you know, poverty of meaning? People in dire isolation or loneliness are actually, in a sense, can be poor in another way. And it's basically, I think you're right. I think, you know, that is often the case, is that people do perceive people being in poor as what they have or what they what they do. And at the same time, it's basically coming back to the idea that actually today many people are on the breadline. And that was coming back to the food bank. There was some of the food banks discovered that in the summer holiday there was a spike in demand, basically showing that the amount of working families relying on free school meals. And obviously when the schools broke up for holiday, actually finding the money to actually cover that cost of those that extra food for the children was not there, and so then there was a rise in food bank usage. So it's a very hard subject, because obviously it can be explored on many levels, and you can go anywhere with it, from across all different societies and different cultures. And it's and hopefully I did my best in the book to build a narrative that basically. It basically comes onto that is to try and meet it in what way we can, and to better understand what's causing it.
Matthew, thanks for joining us. Your book, Down and Out Today, Notes from the Gutter, What Does Poverty Mean Today and How Can We Move Forward, is out now. It's $9.99, is that right?
It is indeed, yes.
Excellent stuff. Thank you for joining us, Matthew.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. That was Matthew Smaller, author. By the way, Dan Clark, someone is listening. My girlfriend is listening to the show. She wanted me to point out that obviously, you know, I was talking about that beautiful girl that I never met on the internet.
Yeah.
She says,
has this opened a can of worms?
Tommy, don't be silly. Of course you met up with a beautiful girl you met on online dating. Then she moved in.
Hey, there you go.
So, you are right, Sophie. You are the one beautiful girl that I did meet on the internet.
It's quite and
I
managed full of herself, isn't she?
And I managed to keep you up, scoop you up and keep you forever.
Yeah.
There you go. Anyway, thanks for your text, Soph. I'm glad you're listening. It's good to know.
I didn't meet my girlfriend online. In an age where that seems to happen, I went acoustic. And met her in a actual room.
Really?
Yeah.
In what sense?
Well, how many senses of a room is
there? She was just in a room?
She was in a room. I'd paid someone to put a woman in a room and I'd go in and sort of have
a look.
You're
so old-fashioned.
Yeah. just at a party. Like, classic seeing someone across the room and then speaking to them. It's very, very... It's almost like, does that happen anymore? I'm sure it does.
But are you good at chatting up the ladies?
Maybe back in the day.
See, I was always used to sat it. I wasn't scared of asking people out, but I wasn't very good. I would never just chat somebody up. That was just not my sort of thing. I'm not really... And also, I don't think I'm that attractive on a first off sense, right? You know, what is attractive about me is something you get to know me.
After they've done a double take,
yes.
Suddenly you're beautiful.
I'm not that big. Anyway, Dan Clark, let's play another one of your songs. How about Modern Love by David Bowie? Is that...
I wanted to... This song, right? So David Bowie is someone that I thought I knew pretty much quite a lot about. And I was in a clothes shop about a year ago and this song came on. I was like, I've heard this song before, I like this. Who is it? It's like one of those people that had one hit and then I did the old Shazam or whatever and it was David Bowie. And I felt genuinely ashamed of myself that I didn't know that, because I thought, I know all the hits surely, this is from his... I think Noel Rogers did this song and or produced this album. I think he had something to do with it.
Very good. Modern Love by David Bowie. Here we go, it's Fubar Radio.
I catch a fever, boy, with
It's 11:38. We're coming into the last 20 minutes of the show, actually. It's gone very, very quickly. And partly to do with that is the man I'm sat opposite, Dan Clark, comedian, who's my co-presenter today and has made this show go really quick and brilliantly. Anyway, we've got a little business section now. Basically, we've got a guy called Nick Green who's about to join us. He is the CEO and founder of an app called Tripper. It's a social travel app that connects people going to the same place. Founded by three Oxford graduates, the app has been downloaded over 20,000 times in 130 countries. But what is it, and is it any good? Here he is to join us on the line. Nick Green, are you there?
We are. I'm actually here with my business partner, Alec, as well. How are you doing?
Hello, guys. You all right?
Brilliant. Thanks so much for chatting with us.
Oh, you're welcome. Briefly, what is your app all about, and does it work? Is it any good?
Yeah, you pretty much hit the nail on the head. We connect people who are going to the same place in the future, so you arrive connected.
The same place in the future?
Yep, same place in the future. You're connecting in time and space. So
wow.
Picture where you're next going on holiday.
You boys are good.
Do you know what? I tell you, if you invented a time-travelling app, that would be the best thing in the world.
Or you could just say it is, like these hoverboards. They're not really hoverboards, but they're saying they are.
Well, we're still legal. I guess at the basis of it, we're really tackling three fears that we've seen travellers experience. The fear of missing out. We can show you where your friends are going to in the future. The fear of being alone, in that we see a lot of solo travelers going around South America, Southeast Asia, and they're happy to connect with other people to travel with. And then the fear of the unknown, which is we let you connect with locals in different towns so you can ask them for advice that you wouldn't necessarily read in Lonely Planet or anything like that. And we sort of bring all those three fears into one app and sort of improve the social experience of people travelling.
Hmm. And how do these people, say, you know, locals or whatever, are they vetted? Because, I mean, you know, you are sending strangers out into strange countries to meet new strangers, and obviously there could be difficulties and issues with that.
They're sending them out.
Well, they're not sending them out, but you're connecting strangers, effectively, in a strange place.
I guess our story on that is that you can meet a stranger in a bar when you go to Paris, but there's no vetting there at all. At least, yeah, it's all done through Facebook, so you can check them out, see if you have any mutual friends, look at their photos, see what bit of their history, where they studied. I mean, you can make that judgment a bit better.
Yeah.
And then also communicating before you get there, you can get a better feel for someone than just meeting them on a night out.
And how's it going? Have you managed to monetize it yet?
The monetization is coming on now. We're actually raising money on Crowdkeep at the moment to sort of expand the growth. Everything we've done so far has been focused on the app, and we haven't really marketed it, so... The fact that we've had any downloads is just through sort of lucky PR. But the app's great now. You should just download it, have it a go. We also just recently added a new feature for adding kudos to your profile if you've been helpful. So that's another way of someone who is a trustworthy local will slowly go up on the sort of trust scale within the app.
Okay.
That makes sense.
Great. Nick, thank you for joining us. I'm sorry I got cut you off early. We haven't got a great deal of time, but it sounds interesting. So it's Tripper, T-R-I-P-R, and you can download that on the iTunes App Store.
It's an app of time travel. So get it now. If you ever travel, it'll make the best out of your next trip, and we'd love you to download it, so give it a go.
Excellent. Great. Thank you very much, Nick.
Thanks so much, Jim. Have a great day.
Cheers. Thanks. That's Nick Green, who's the CEO and founder of Tripper app. I wonder if we can sort people out with drugs, because I mean that's often what people want, isn't it, when they go abroad?
I'm not sure that's what he wants you to say about it, but yeah. isn't there you know, like the Bitcoin thing, wasn't there a app or something that enabled people to buy and sell drugs?
Oh, maybe.
I think there was.
Really?
Yeah, and the reason I'm bringing that up is because I know how much you love your drugs.
But they can get that out. They could probably, iTunes Store would say it's illegal, so they could ban that. I often thought
it's like the PayPal of drugs.
You go through stations in London. It doesn't happen so much anymore. But a while ago, they were doing this really big effort where they would have dogs at police stations, outside tube stations, and you know, people would be walking through there with a tiny bit of weed or whatever, and then they would get arrested. And I thought, someone should create an app to say, are there dogs at
the dog app.
To avoid police dogs and stuff. But I mean, obviously, I wouldn't need to use it, but you know, it was just a thing that I thought about.
You could just
pretend, oh, there's dogs everywhere. Don't go on the tube. There's dogs everywhere.
You're starting to sound like some sort of dog conspiracy theorist now. There's dogs everywhere.
Well, that is me. Right, let's play another song and then we'll come back and with a little sports section. Make You Better by the Decemberists, right?
Yeah.
Good one. Let's play it. And we'll come back with James Montague, world football expert, in the final little section after this. Here we go.
I wanted you.
11:48, we're into the last little section of today's show. 2 hours goes quick, doesn't it, Dan Clark, my co-presenter?
It does. I was surprised. I was dreading this. And
But it's actually okay.
It's all right. It's fun. It is fun.
We're into the sport. We've got a new way we're formatting this show, and we're going to put sport. We've put sport at the back like a newspaper. And we've got world football journalist James Montague who's going to join us on the line. He recently, you might have seen, Serbia Albania was in the news when a man flew a drone with the Kosovan Albanian flag on it a year ago this week, in fact, into the stadium, which was then torn down by Serbia players, causing a riot and an international incident. Now, James Montague interviewed the man who flew the drone, and he's on Skype now to explain a little bit about it. Hello, James.
How you doing?
I'm all right, mate. Thanks for joining us. So, I mean, this was quite an incident, wasn't it? And you interviewed the man. He's now a hero in his country.
Well, yeah, he's also in jail. But that's we'll get to that in a second. I mean, the main thing about this, I was watching this. I was actually watching it on television, the game last year, Albania Serbia in Belgrade at the FK Partizan Stadium. And anyone that knows a little bit about the history of the Balkans knows that this is a bigger rivalry as, say, Croatia-Serbia. Even though they've not been directly at war, the Kosovo War in 1999 was essentially a separatist province within Serbia that is a majority Albanian, ethnically Albanian. So this was always going to be a kind of hugely important game and, you know, tensions running high on both sides. And then, you know, suddenly you see this four-coptered drone kind of fly into the stadium. And a crowd that had already been singing lots of kind of, it had already been quite a feeble atmosphere, lots of kill the Albanians until they're dead, stab them to death.
Lovely.
Horrible.
And they say, you know, Chelsea supporters are
Millwall's bad.
Well, they don't have anything on these guys, you know. And this drone comes in, and on it is a flag, you know, and it's, I have to ask Rory Smith, the Times guy, because he's a classic scholar, and he tells me this is a Greek word, and I always say this wrong. Autochthonous or chothunus?
We'll take your word for it.
We'll take her that, but it means native, and it had a map of Greater Albania, which is this kind of nationalistic concept of Albanians that live all across the Balkans having a big country, and it's seen as quite offensive to many Serbs. So this was just like throwing petrol onto the fire. There was obviously a riot on the pitch. There was riots in the stands. The match was postponed. It was abandoned, and then it was the hunt of who flew the drone. And at first, everybody in the Serbian media blamed the prime ministers of Albania's brother. So he was apparently arrested, although he denied it, and then he was taken out and basically deported. The entire Albanian team had their bag searched, looking for the remote control. And so then they didn't find it. Eventually, UEFA decided that this was, through CAS, eventually made the decision that Albania should be awarded the 3 points. And then Serbia docked a further 3 points because they failed to control the crowd. So, basically ended Serbia's chances of qualifying for the European Championships. Remember, this is a team that won the under-20s World Cup recently. So they've got a lot of great young players coming through. They would have been and you've got players like Ivanovic and Matic, they'd have been an asset to the tournament. And who it was, actually, I actually found him through Facebook. He'd given one interview on Albanian television where he said, it was me, and I found him. He was a crane driver who was working in Italy, and he just had this crazy plan. He did it. He managed to get out of the country, and then he became a national hero. And because of this act, he then got, I actually met him the day before my story came out in the New York Times, or interviewed him. We did another interview, and he pulled out a gun that he has on him to keep that he keeps for safekeeping because he gets regular threats from Serbians these days. Wow. Next thing I know, half an hour later, he's been bundled into the back of a Albanian police car and been arrested for having an unlicensed pistol. So it was crazy. This guy's like a national hero. Albania probably wouldn't have qualified if he hadn't have done this. I mean, they'd be in the playoffs for sure. But they probably wouldn't have qualified. So this guy is seen as a national hero, and he's currently languishing in jail.
But I suspect he's nobody's bitch.
Well, I mean, this guy's like a normal guy. He's small. He's got curly hair. He's just a normal working class.
But I bet in prison he's being treated like a god. I mean, I bet they all love him, right? He must be a hero in there.
To be honest, I haven't managed to get through to him. I did go to the police station. I did go to the police station to try to talk to him. But a couple of the ultras, the national team ultras, actually initially thought it was my fault. He was in jail, so I got accosted a couple of times saying, "Your article you wrote about the gun." Therefore, and I had to tell them, "Look, it came out 6 hours later." But the police loved it because they then had a foreigner to blame for it. So it was on the front pages of all the Albanian newspapers, saying that New York Times journalist James Montague had said that he had a gun, and the police acted accordingly. So for a few brief hours, I was like the most hated man in Albania.
So now you're carrying a gun, and then you'll get arrested, and then
it's
it'll
like
carry on.
Biggie and Tupac all over again. So did the guy do this? Did he get the outcome he was after? Like, was he just sort of like wanted his team to win, or did he want to incite some sort of like, you know, new
international
war.
Incident.
Yeah.
Well, I asked this question to him. I said, look, I mean, you know, well, I mean, maybe you didn't know, but I knew that doing this kind of thing could provoke a war. I mean, okay. Wars have been started for less provocative.
It's just banter, mate. It's just banter.
Well, this is it. A Serbian guy tweeted me and said, this is the best football trolling ever. You know, and I think it probably is. I mean, if you take it out of its context, of all the political context, I mean, it is a work of genius. Probably a work of performance art, almost.
Do you think he realised it would create such a big incident, or he was just doing it for japes and that?
It's kind of like your mate down the pub who always ends up losing his job every few years, has a crazy idea, and you go, don't worry, Dave, it's not going to happen. And Dave goes out and then becomes an international man of mystery and creates an international diplomatic incident. That's how I feel. Like, it's a crazy, somehow in the universe, you know, 100 different circumstances all aligned at the same time that allowed this to happen. In every other parallel dimension that exists, this hasn't happened. But in our one, it has. So I don't think he knows it. I don't think he realised it happened. And when it did, I think he thought that he was engendering a kind of feeling of patriotism amongst Albanians and hoping to get them to France. And I guess ultimately that has been achieved. I mean, you can't take it away from the players. They've done a fantastic job. I mean, beating Portugal away. They've just beat Armenia 3-0 to qualify. You know, they've had a fantastic campaign. It's one of the smallest nations in Europe. So, you know, obviously the players have to take the majority of the credit. But, I mean, I think they'd probably be in the playoffs if it wasn't for Ishmael Marina.
Lad. Anyway, James. James Montague, thank you for joining us. Fascinating story there, mate. Cheers very much. That's James Montague, world football hero. What a lad that geezer sounds.
Well, I reckon they...
LAD positive.
You could actually solve international problems with a football match. Like, let's get Israel to play Palestine and the winner decides who owns that territory, right?
I think we're onto something here.
Yeah?
And it's entertaining as well. I don't see a downside, Dan.
No, I don't. And also, how much more interested in the game do you become as a spectator when you know
it's life or death. It's literally life or death. We're coming towards the end of the show, unfortunately, and I've had a great time with you, Dan. It's been great.
It's been a pleasure.
We've had a couple of...
I'm going to stay.
For the next show. Yeah. They'll be delighted to hear that. We've had a couple of emails in. What was your biggest blag off the back of the guy who blagged his way into the Merseyside derby by pretending to be in a wheelchair? Sarah from London emails at tom@foobarradio.com to say, once blagged a free trip to Portugal after winning a competition in a magazine, all expenses paid, couldn't believe my luck. That's not really a blag, is it, Sarah? That's
winning a competition.
Jim from Kent says, my mate once blagged himself and us free drinks all evening as people believed he was actually Ricky Hatton. Yeah. Have anyone ever thought you were anybody else, Dan?
I'm confused with Nicholas Burns, who was in Nathan Barley all the time.
Oh yes, yeah. I can see that. He's put on quite a lot of weight though now, and you've kept the weight off.
Because I know and like Nick, and
but
I don't
he has
know
put on a bit of weight. He's getting old. It happens to us all, my friend. It happens to us all. Well, I once got Josh Hartnett, but that ship has long sailed. So you know,
I once blagged a pint. All I had to do was pay £3 for it.
That is
just
good.
In the vein of the that woman who blagged something by entering a competition.
But that is good in London.
Yeah, that's not bad,
You can't
get
a £3
But this
anyway.
Was back in the early 2000s.
When actually that was expensive.
Yeah.
Anyway, Dan Clark, thanks for joining
me.
And please come and do it again.
I would love to, definitely.
And people can find out more about you at danclarkcomedy.com.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. Okay. Only a little bit.
He's going on. Yeah, but you've got all the important bits.
Yeah,
all the important bits. And thanks everybody who came on my show today. The papers and the news hour. Channel 4 journalist Paul McNamara, also Baroness Jenny Jones, for coming on. Author Matthew Small on his book on poverty in the UK, and also world football expert James Montague on the weekend's international football. Oh, no, it wasn't the weekend's international football, it was about the Serbian incident, the international incident. Coming up at 4 p.m. today is Sarah Hugh and Doc 2. You can download all my interviews as a podcast from iTunes and SoundCloud, as ever. I won't see you next week because it's my birthday, so I'm having a week off. I'm going to Manchester if anyone cares.
A whole week off for your birthday.
I'm like the Queen.
Yeah.
Anyway, we'll play out with a bit of Frank Sinatra. Can't beat it. I've got you under my skin. Dan Clark, thanks very much.
Thank
you're
you.
A hero. Cheers. Bye.
Bye.
I've got you under my skin. I've got you deep in the heart of me. So deep in my heart that you're really a part of me. I've got you under my skin. I tried so not to give in. I said to myself, this affair never will go so well. But why should I try to resist when, baby, I know so well? I've got you under my skin. I'd sacrifice anything come what might for the sake of having you near, in spite of a warning voice that comes in the night and repeats, repeats in my ear. Don't you know, little fool, you never can win. Use your mentality, wake up to reality. But each time that I do, just the thought of you makes me stop before I begin. 'Cause I've got you under my skin. Sacrifice anything, come what might, for the sake of having you near, in spite of a warning voice that comes in the night and repeats how it yells in my ear. Don't you know, little fool, you never can win. Why not use your mentality? Step up, wake up to reality. I've got you under my skin. Yes, I've got you under my skin.